Mics are live.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is a consolidated informal hearings on case PU-17268, Montana Dakota Utilities Company's advanced determination of prudence on the Thunder Spirit Wind expansion, and case PU-17-269, Montana Dakota Utilities Company's Thunder Spirit Wind expansion certificate of public convenience and necessity. It is 3:03 p.m. on November 3rd, 2017. I'm Randy Christman, Chairman of the Commission. With me is Commissioner Brian Crashus and Julie Fedorchek, so we have a quorum. Also, Steve Call from staff. And if you would pass the microphone around, and everyone from MDU, identify yourself for the record, including everyone in the...
Garrett Singer with Montana Dakota.
Carl Liepitz, Assistant General Counsel with MDU Resources.
Darcy Nigam, Montana Dakota.
Tammy Eberle, Montana Dakota.
Jay Scable, Montana Dakota.
Alan Welty, Montana Dakota.
Mark Hansen, MDU Resources.
And Travis Jacobson, Montana Dakota.
Thank you, and we also expect Jerry Leon from our staff to be in here real shortly. He's just wrapping up a previous phone conversation. This is, as I mentioned, an informal hearing, which means that we will only be dealing in facts that are not in dispute. If we get into any facts that are disputed, we'll have to wrap this up and proceed to a formal hearing. I don't have any opening comments. Do either of you?
I do not.
Okay, we'll turn it over and hear from the company first.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Again, I am Carl Liepitz with MDU Resources, and we appreciate the opportunity to get together and review this matter. So as you mentioned, MDU did file for in June of 2017 for both an advanced determination of prudency and a amended certificate of public convenience and necessity. And the hearing was noticed for a consolidated hearing under both cases. And in that notice, there were three issues that were presented. The first is whether the proposed expansion of Thunder Spirit would be a prudent investment. The second is whether the public convenience and necessity will be served by the expansion. And then third, of course, is whether or not MDU is fit, willing, and able to provide that service. Mr. Nigam will go through a much more detailed description of the project and the economics, but in the end, we respectfully request that the commission find that the investment is, in fact, prudent, that the expansion would, in fact, serve the public convenience and necessity, and then finally that MDU is fit, willing, and able to serve that project. And so with that, I will conclude the opening remarks and turn it over to Darcy.
Thank you, Carl. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Just a little bit of update, or I should say a little overview, at least of the Thunder Spirit Wind project itself. This project was originally sited and permitted as a 150-megawatt wind project located near Hettinger in Adams County. The first phase of the project was 107.5 megawatts, and it was completed in December of 2015. Montana Dakota did purchase the project at its commercial operation date from Elite Clean Energy and Thunder Spirit Wind. Along with the purchase of the first phase, Montana Dakota also purchased the development rights for the full 150-megawatt project. This is at least a little layout of the project perimeters itself. This is the town of Hettinger here, so the whole project site is located to the north and slightly to the east of Hettinger. When we talk about the first phase project, it would entail this area here in blue, and the expansion would be over in this additional area immediately adjacent to the first phase of the project. This is a picture of a few of the turbines that are installed out at Thunder Spirit for the first phase. As you can see, this is a mixture of kind of farmland, a little bit of grazing land, not much that it has for homes, at least located within the project, and has very strong landowner support and also strong support from the county. The first phase of the project did consist of 43 Nordex turbines, each one being 2.5 megawatts in size. The first year's net capacity factor, or average production that the project had, was 45.3%, which was pretty much right on target with what was forecasted, at least for the performance of this project. Total project costs of the first phase were $214 million, or approximately $1,990 per installed kilowatt. The project substation was designed and built for the 150-megawatt project in size, so the generator step-up transformer is for the 150 megawatts, and it also interconnects into Montana Dakota's transmission system at our 230 kV Hettinger Junction substation, which was located in the corner of the project. In 2017, we also received 20.6 megawatts of accredited capacity for the Thunder Spirit Wind project. As part of the development of our 2017 Integrated Resource Plan, we did go out for a request for proposals, looking for competitive bids. One of the projects that was submitted to us was from Elite Clean Energy, as I mentioned before, who was the original developer of the Thunder Spirit project, and they did propose to us an expansion project. And so we held all of the future rights. They came in and proposed a project to us to complete that, and they would do that and basically either have a 25-year power purchase agreement if they would own the project, or they would also include in that at least an option for us to purchase it at our choice. That project was sized for up to a 50-megawatt project size. That number was kind of out there because it was unsure if they would be using 3-megawatt or 3.6-megawatt turbines. We also did sign a purchase power agreement with Elite Clean Energy through our lease cost studies we did for the Integrated Resource Plan, and that was signed back in December of 2016. Inside the 25-year power purchase agreement, along with the purchase option, there were a couple items for pricing adjustments if Elite would ultimately be the owner of the project. So in other words, if we'd be purchasing energy under the power purchase agreement. Some of the adjustments included final changes in tax equity rates. So if they would be the project owner, they would have to go out for tax equity financing. And so at least in the project, there was kind of a target price, at least what was estimated that the market was at the signing of the power purchase agreement. One of the other ones would be any sort of changes in federal corporate income tax rates. There'd be a price adjustment for that as well. And also any material changes in the project scope that the company would request would have some ability to flow through and change the power purchase price.
Darcy, so what is the, help me think through the impact of changes in federal income taxes, because it's certainly an active proposal right now. So if federal corporate income taxes are cut significantly, what does that do to your cost of power?
Okay. You'll end up with at least two impacts. One, certainly if the corporate tax rate goes down as a corporation, we'll be paying less tax. So at least it is more revenue or at least earnings that we would generate because we'd be paying less in taxes. As it pertains to the project itself, you know, the production tax credits themselves, you know, offset revenue we would have to collect from our customers otherwise. And the way you can look at doing that is take the value of the tax credit, the 2.4 cents, and if you gross them up for taxes that you would pay, you come up with a pre-tax equivalent value of those tax credits. So if they're worth 2.4 cents and you would gross them up for taxes, 35%, 39% you know, corporate tax rate, you divide it by 0.65, 0.63, and what you would end up with something closer to 4 cents is a pre-tax equivalent value of the tax credits today at the 35%. So when you take a look at that, it's less of the revenue requirement that offsets the project cost. So on the one side, you're going to end up with the customer, it has to pay a little bit more for the project itself, but the corporation's overall taxable income that we end up, or our corporate tax that we end up paying goes down. So there's two impacts we end up having. One is the project costs a little bit more. The other one is the company becomes more profitable as far as we're paying less in corporate taxes. So as an example, one of the adjustments we had that I mentioned, if there's a change in the federal corporate income tax rate, if we apply the schedule that was in the power purchase agreement, it has like a $2 increase in the cost of the power purchase agreement if the federal income tax rate would change from the 35% currently down to a proposed 20%.
So if the tax goes down, your power purchase agreement goes up?
Yes.
Because why? Why would that be?
So if you take a look at the project itself, there's two parts. One, as a corporation, we're paying less in tax, so we end up having more profit we earn. The other one.
So does the other corporation that's selling it to you.
Correct. But the other one is, if we look at this from our own revenue requirement, if the value of the tax credits at 2.4 cents for this project is somewhere around, I think it's $7.5 million a year. Is
who gets
what it
the tax
to.
Credits, you guys or the?
They flow back to the customer. Oh, no. The tax credits? It depends whoever the owner is. So the owner of the project gets the production tax credit.
We're just talking about the PPA. Under the terms of the PPA, who Correct. Gets it?
It goes back to their tax equity financing. So it impacts the yield rate.
So the tax credits are somehow dealt with in this PPA?
They are. They are in the fact that it changes the amount of revenue, at least that Elite would have to collect for their revenue that they invested in this project, because the corresponding yield rate for the tax equity financing party would actually go up.
Okay. And the customers will pay more then?
So from the standpoint of this part for the energy, they would pay a little bit more. They pay an extra $2
yep.
per megawatt hour.
Okay.
One of the other provisions that's included in the Nordex turbine supply agreement is a 20-year long-term maintenance agreement. That includes all major maintenance costs as far as associated with the turbine. That also would transfer to us in the case if we purchase the project, which we think is a really valuable asset. And so as far as we don't take on the risks as far as gearbox failures, generators, blades, those sorts of pieces, those are all covered, at least in the schedule, that 20-year schedule of maintenance. The project does qualify for the full federal production tax credit, so it did start construction before the end of 2016. And there were actually the turbines for the project were actually purchased last year as well to qualify for the safe harbor provisions. The current schedule has the project scheduled to be completed by the end of December of next year. Through our integrated resource plan, we did identify that the Thunder Spirit PPA was a least cost option, and the purchase option actually provided $4.8 million in additional benefits over the power purchase agreement itself. The Thunder Spirit expansion project was selected as a least cost resources in all sensitivities, including our low growth case. One of the changes that we ended up having, at least in our integrated resource plan, is an update since the time that we did file. Well, we did have an update to our long-term load forecast that we completed in September of this year. One of the changes we ended up seeing was at least a reduction in the annual growth rate of energy for our customers. It decreased from 1.6% down to 1.2% annually over the next 5 years. Also, the average growth rate in peak demand reduced from 1.36% down to 1.2%. One of the projects that we had included, at least on our integrated resource plan, was a residential air conditioning cycling program. In that program was expected to be about 10 megawatts in size. One of the other changes we had, which was a reason we did an update to our integrated resource plan, is we had one of our large industrial customers came in and wanted to add more load underneath our commercial demand response program. That's the one we end up calling our C-Power program that a third party manages. So currently we have 10 megawatts of load that's in that program, and we had forecasted it to increase to 15 megawatts. And we had our largest industrial customer out in Montana came in and wanted to add another 15 megawatts to the program. So it took us to our 25 megawatts really by the end of this year is where we're at. So in that, it reduced the need, at least for the air-conditioned cycling program residential, which was no longer a lease cost option.
Does that cost money, that program?
It does.
Because I hope you bring that back. It just seems like a smart thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much it costs, but I noticed it in your IRP a number of years ago, and I've been looking forward to seeing it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep, so it's one of those that avoids us in having to construct a new resource. Mm-hmm. And so there is a cost to that. I think it's about $4.25 per kilowatt month is what it works out that we pay C-Power, and about 75% of that goes back to the customer. Mm-hmm. So our updated action plan for our 2017 Integrated Resource Plan does have the construction, acquisition of the Thunder Spirit Wind Expansion Project. We also have the pursuing the design and development of a combined cycle natural gas resource to be online on or after 2025, and that we'll continue to meet any short-term capacity deficits either through the MISO capacity auction or through bilateral purchase agreements from others. Regarding the ownership option for the Thunder Spirit expansion project, the total cost of this project is expected to be about $85 million. That works out to about $1,750 per kilowatt, plus we also have an additional $1 million in owner's cost, at least for the acquisition of the project and our management of that acquisition. We do propose to purchase the project at its commercial operation date. The levelized cost of ownership of the Thunder Spirit Wind Project is $22.40 per megawatt hour. Just as a note, the historic five-year average for the last 5 years of the annual MISO average energy purchases that we have made is $24.95.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you because here's where I'm so confused with this proposal. Are you seeking the approval for either option to do either the ownership option or the power purchase agreement? Or were you just laying out how it would work if you did the power purchase agreement, but your actual proposal is to do the purchase option?
Our actual proposal is to purchase the project. You know, the update of this project is we currently have a power purchase agreement for it. We have found it in our customer's best interest, and we have signed that agreement. What we're coming in and asking for is the approval of the purchase option contained within the power purchase agreement. So the 25-year levelized ownership cost of this project, is, as you can see, is less than what we have paid for our annual MISO average energy purchases over the last 5 years. Another note, in 2016, our MISO market energy purchases accounted for 24% of all of our customers' energy. That number is up from 10% back in 2007.
So we you estimate this project will affect that those purchases? How much will they go down?
I think it's about a 5 to 7%. This is another drawing that shows a little bit of the information on the layout for the Thunder Spirit project. The existing turbines are those located in red that you end up seeing. This is the interconnection substation, is down here. This is our Hettinger 230 Junction substation. The yellow dots represent the 16 proposed turbine sites plus three alternate sites that'll make up the project itself.
What's the purpose of the area to the north? And if you take the northernmost, right in there.
So when the project was originally permitted, it was expected the turbine sizes were 2 megawatts, so we would have had 75 proposed sites.
Okay.
Once we get into larger turbines, you know, we end up seeing that the project will have 59. And so these are the farthest away from the interconnection substation and would include the greatest cost to end up building underground collection systems to get up there. And the better wind resources we end up finding are in this area down here anyway. A couple of the other additional analysis that we ended up doing, when we ended up looking at the ownership option, And we would compare that against the forecasted MISO energy prices, at least over the next 25 years, based upon the base case we had in our 2017 Integrated Resource Plan. So we'd compare that MISO energy price we're forecasting versus our cost that we would have for our financial model for the ownership case. And we would take the net present value of the difference of those. We end up finding there's approximately $19 million in net present value savings over our base cases versus purchasing MISO energy only. If we end up looking at our low market price forecast, so instead of looking at the difference between a longer time horizon, which we had in the base case, if we looked at what energy prices were in the last 12 months, which are closer, would be at the low end of what we've seen, we end up seeing that that savings is still $5.9 million in saving in that 25-year comparison. One of the other ones we took a look at doing was our modeling does give us information on annual revenue requirements for our entire supply portfolio over the 20-year study period. So out through 2036, if we look at the difference in the annual revenue requirements between the purchase option and what we would have for our base case, which was in the power purchase agreement, we end up seeing that there's savings of $7.3 million in the ownership option over the purchase power agreement option. Earlier this year, we did file for an amendment, at least in our siting certificate with this commission, and that what we ended up seeking to do was to increase the total project size to 155 megawatts. That would better match our MISO generator interconnection agreement, which allows for 150 megawatts of net generation. The siting certificate pertained to what the generation was out at the turbines or the nameplate. So there's a little bit of difference when you look at losses through the project, at least that you end up having for the underground cables, the electric losses, and also through the interconnection facilities. So we were able to come in at 155 megawatt project, have a little greater economies of scale, reduced total project cost for this. In that, we also propose to utilize 3-megawatt Nordex wind turbine machines, so larger than the 2.5-megawatt machines that we have today. We also did file for an amendment of our Adams County conditional use permit, which also we requested the use of 155 megawatts for a total project size. That amended conditional use permit was approved on August 8th. And this commission did approve the amendment to our siting certificate back on August 16th. In increasing the total project size to 155 megawatts, that did set the size of the expansion project to 48 megawatts for a total project size. So as Mr. Lipitz indicated before, we did file for an amendment to our certificate of public convenience and necessity. The original Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity was issued on June 30th of 2015. The Public Convenience and Necessity will be served by Montana Dakota's ownership of the 48-megawatt expansion project. The standards continue to meet. Montana Dakota is fit and willing and able to own and operate the 48-megawatt expansion project. In conclusion, as we look at our application for the advanced determination of prudency and the amended certificate of public convenience and necessity, we end up have shown at least that we meet all the requirements for the certificate of public convenience and necessity. The expansion project is a prudent investment. It serves as a low-cost generating resource, as demonstrated through our 2017 Integrated Resource Plan. The project does help to meet our future energy needs of our customers, and it does provide market energy price protection.
Darcy, I have it's not really a question, just confirm some information that make sure I'm understanding correctly, and this is from your application on page 6. You talk about the cost estimates, and right at the bottom of that paragraph, it says the first year cost to customers above the MISO market purchases that will be avoided is estimated at just a fraction of a cent per kilowatt, with net savings estimated for years 2 through 10. And so the net savings projected is estimated to be 19.1 million as compared to forecasted market energy purchases. So if I'm reading that, at what point, so this is saving customers money compared to what they're currently paying?
Correct.
How, at what point do customers see that in their bill? I mean, is there a way to track this through, or why does it always seem like these kind of savings get washed out because everything else is going up?
So one of those we end up seeing is, at least when we look at our fuel and purchase power rates, you know, they're significantly lower than what they were before we started into our investment in renewables. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of the places that it flows through. We have less fuel that we're purchasing because we end up owning these resources that are zero fuel, so we end up seeing that component is less.
Do you guys communicate that in any way to customers? I mean, aside from just what's visible on a bill, is it too complicated to try to communicate that?
Communicate what is no longer flowing through a purchase from MISO versus putting in the new investment. I mean, that is, how do you get that across, right? That they should see in their bill that you'd have a...
Mm-hmm.
They would see in their bill a reduction in that FCA fuel clause adjustment, and that's where you would see the benefit.
Yeah, unless they're using more.
Unless your energy usage changes period to period.
They
right.
don't see that.
Right.
I just think that there's so much confusion out there about customers are told that they're saving money with renewables, but they're never seeing it on their bills. And so it seems like it's a big fib. You know, it almost feels like we're lying or that it's not real. So it's just another, I just say it because I think utilities, you need to start focusing on that, communicating what's going on to customers, because there's a lot of changes occurring out there, and some of it might be that they're being lost, those savings are being lost by increases in other areas like MISO for mm-hmm. transmission. And so, you know, that gets back to one of my other pet peeves, is that are they really saving money when we're building out all this new transmission to serve the renewables? So is it in the end a savings? Because there's never an all-in analysis that's being done that I can see. Maybe there is some place, but I haven't seen that. The other question, though, is so it's also confusing when customers know that the existing facilities, the coal facilities, say, that you own, aren't being run at 100%. So why are you adding? And so I just want to make sure that my little explanation is accurate. You're not running those at 100% or at their max because it's actually cheaper to just buy it off the market.
Correct.
And so this is even cheaper yet.
Yes.
To build this and own this is cheaper yet than buying it off the market.
Correct. Yep.
Okay.
Will this increase then the cost of the coal-fired plant in terms of energy produced, if it's, say it's going from 70% to 60% or whatever, when it drops, it's less efficient, correct?
It is, but, you know, we end up, you have two parts to that. So one is at least the fixed cost, which is still needed and provides benefit to the customer, still provides the same benefit. You know, there is an inefficiency that does go through as far as if you run it, you know, at a lower load. You know, the offset of that is if we would run it at the higher load, what we would end up seeing is we'd be putting in the market really at potentially a loss position. And so you have the inefficiency, but the other one is you could be generating at you know, $30 per megawatt hour and the market price is $25, and you're losing a $5 position between what your load is paying and what your generation is getting paid.
No, I don't have I'll have to, it just, one seems to be mm-hmm. pushing costs down. I understand that you've got a lower price point if you were just to buy it. but we're increasingly making coal-fired plants less efficient when they're not running.
They're less efficient, but the customer receives some of that benefit because rather than, you know, to continue to burn the fuel, which is potentially at a higher cost, they're able to use a lesser cost energy at that period of time. That also flows back in fuel and purchase power savings to the customer.
Can you explain, or just anecdotally, you're projecting, you had changed the load growth or energy growth percentage from 1.65 down to 1.23?
Correct.
Percent, just anecdotally, I think you had explained part of that. Could you run that by me again?
So one of the things that we did is when we conducted our 2017 integrated resource plan, you know, we had to use the most current load forecast that was available. So in that case, it was the one that we had completed the end of 2016. Our updates normally come out in September of every year. So when the update came out, we ended up seeing at least that our energy growth rate had continued to drop. Some of that was just seen by when we look at growth of, you know, new customer loads and even where we're at sales to date to historic. So we had dropped our forecast level. The other one that we had is really because of the large increase in our commercial demand response program. We went back into our model just to see if something had changed. And so in that changing, the Thunder Spirit Wind expansion project is still picked as a least cost. We ended up seeing we didn't have the need for the air conditioned cycling program anymore, just because of the increase in the commercial demand response. And so that was really the point of talking about the load forecast. Really didn't change our customers' energy need, but the increase in demand response from our industrial customers really eliminated the need today for that other program that we had included in our integrated resource plan.
So that dropped it by 25%?
We would have. So we were looking at adding on the residential air conditioned cycling was a 10 megawatt program, and what we ended up adding was 10 megawatts in commercial demand response. So the net effect on the programs, whether it was commercial demand response or air conditioned cycling, turned out to be the same. They were kind of a wash, but it ended up eliminating that one program from our consideration.
Okay, Darcy, I want to jump back to your PPA. We've had some PPAs that we've seen where the production tax credit value is spread out over the life of 20 or 25 or 30 years. And so the amount that the utility is paying for the power is either the same throughout or just gradually increasing with inflation, but that 10-year value of those PTCs is spread out over the whole term. Do I understand right? Is your PPA different than that? That the PTCs, the benefit of the PTCs, are experienced during those first 10 years, and then after that, the cost to you for the power would be significantly more.
So there are two parts to that. One is, you know, there are various variations of what you end up seeing in power purchase agreements, you know, whether it's just a single flat rate over the entire term. I think you indicated the other one is you see a starting point with something like a 1, 1.5, 2% escalator. You may end up seeing to that annual price. One of the things that was quoted to us from Elite was more of a pricing mechanism where it was low and flat, at least the first 10 years. And then they ended up actually to at least provide those production tax credit values, you know, to the company when they were earned through the PPA price. And then there was a step increase that we would end up seeing when those tax credits go off.
And then if you do the purchase, is that how you intend to have your rates reflected, that it'll be significantly less in those first 10 years and then your consumers in years 11 on will not benefit from those anymore? Or would it be your intention to spread the value of those PTCs over the life of the facility?
The customers would receive the value of those PTCs as they're earned. So they would end up seeing a significant reduction in the in the revenue cost or their energy prices, particularly through 10, and then there would be an adjustment, at least when the tax credits are no longer eligible, at least in what the price is to the consumer.
So in either event, this is going to end up being a significant increase after year 10?
There will be an increase that it will have. You know, the comparison ends up being, how does that price compare to what market prices are in the future, if it ends up being consistent, you know, significantly higher, or if it's in line what market prices will be.
The offset to the PTCs, like in year 11, would be that your investment base, your rate base is less. So you would be charging the customer less because you'd be depreciating or amortizing that out over 20 years. So your net investment would be less in year 11 than year 1. So that'll offset the cessation then of the PTCs as you go through the last 10 years of that.
I don't have any more questions.
Brian, do you?
More of a curiosity question. The maintenance agreements, or the maintenance agreement, is that standard that it runs for 20 years regardless of the style of turbine? Is that just an industry norm?
No, it is not. So it's actually something that was unique about this opportunity. You know, the other one is we have the ability and we're trying to negotiate, you know, a similar long-term arrangement for the first phase of the project. So for today, we end up having only a two-year, you know, warranty with a maintenance supply agreement for the first 5 years. We're trying to go and get a value from Nordex for what that long-term maintenance would be to get the two agreements to match up, which we think will provide, you know, savings on the original project as well.
Is it like buying an extended warranty?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Not to put it in real simple terms, but sometimes that helps me out. So, okay. And then you said after 2025, a natural gas facility would likely come online?
That is what we're looking at, yes.
Does that have anything to do with the expansion potential over by the Heskett or at the Heskett?
That is the site that we're looking at. Yep, utilizing what's there and the existing interconnections. So one of the things that we're studying at the same time, you know, for a project of that size is certainly, you know, potential unit retirements and when those might happen at some point in the future.
Okay. I don't think I have any other questions.
The last slide that I had, this was actually a ship that came into the port of Duluth in April. So actually, when we talk about purchasing turbines and the safe harbor turbines, this was actually the first supply of equipment that came through the port.
Is that the safe harbor?
It is a very safe harbor.
Safe harbor.
Should name it.
Yep, safe very, very safe harbor.
I don't think it would be very safe if L&M saw that photo.
I'm going to just sake so you have a chance to respond. I don't know how many of these we've done. It does concern me, and I think Brian's example of something being similar to an extended warranty makes a good example of it. There's probably not too much to go wrong with these in the first short time, but you cover that over the long term because something eventually does go wrong, and it concerns me when we're going to use the value of those PTCs all up in the first 10 years that the program runs and not spread them out over the life of the project. We're really setting ourselves up for some enormous rate increases after that 10th year as we do this, and everyone's doing it all at the same time with the expectation this program ends. And when we get out into the late 20s and early 30s, I don't know what that generation are going to do.
Yeah.
Because they're going to be stuck with these assets unless we do like we're doing with our coal plants and just leave these set and build new things. It's concerning, so you can respond to that.
Sure. So one of the things we do have, I would say, with the renewable fleet that we do have, you know, they did not come online all at the same time. And so we talk about, at least rather than having the impact of everything and all at once, it is kind of spread out. And so we do have at least the first turbines that we installed at Diamond Willow, you know, back in 2007 are actually rolling off their production tax credits this year. So we end up seeing at least that blend that we're going to end up seeing. And also when we get out to these projects and we end up seeing when these tax credits come off, those other ones are becoming more depreciated, at least as an asset goes themselves. And so there is a little bit of balance that we end up seeing just based upon the timing of the portfolio that we end up having for resources. One of the other ones I would say is this does not accompany 100% of our generation. You know, where this will take us to on a total energy today is from about 20% of our customers' energy to about 25% on an annual basis.
Anything else from the company? Jerry?
Do you have a mic?
How this works. You'll buy these things from Elite and own them, right?
Correct.
And so that cost you pay for them from Elite will go into the rate base?
It will.
And so then there will be no cost of energy when they're running.
Correct.
And so if you have production tax credits, they come off your income tax bill. And is that right? I mean, for every kilowatt hour that you produce, you get to subtract 2.34 cents or whatever it is from your income tax.
The PTCs flow through the renewable rider, and that is given right directly back to the customer, lowers the customer's bill as a result of that, the PTCs.
So the investment goes in the renewable rider and the value of those tax credits goes right back as an offset.
Okay. That's what I'm forgetting is the renewable rider. Okay.
And that's the advantage of the rider is that as the PTCs, the investment reduces and you still have the PTCs, you to true that up and that rate should, you know, for the particular project would go be lower every year.
So you wouldn't get production tax credits through the renewable rider back to the customer at that point. And if the renewable rider is even still in effect, but the fuel cost adjustment would still be zeros on your energy that you produce.
Correct.
So. And if you don't have any income tax liability or you don't have enough to cover what you have in credits, they carry over for how long?
They carry over for up to 10 years.
10 years.
Yep. So the first ones in year one you have to use before year 11. And so the ones in year 10 would be up to year 20.
And if they cut your corporate taxes, though, you won't have as much of a income tax. So that could potentially reduce the value of those PTCs.
Or it could extend them out longer, too.
Extend them out longer.
And then if there's some, you know, in regards to the revenue requirement, if there's a lower tax rate, that would flow through the rider as well. So the customer get the benefit of that lower income tax rate on the investment through the rider. You true that up every year. It'll be part of that calculation.
Are there any adjustments proposed in what's been at least publicly made available as far as a new tax reform proposal that impact the amount of PTCs that would be available?
Nothing that would change the eligibility or the amount. The only thing that was proposed, I think, was just a change in the corporate income tax rate.
Sounds like the utility should be doing news releases about how the change in corporate tax is going to lower people's rates. So mm-hmm. they should be. You guys support it.
Mm-hmm. Once it gets approved, right? I mean, that's mm-hmm.
Well, it won't get approved if there's no support, and if everybody thinks that it's only benefiting the corporations. Have they? Okay. Well, I'll be sure to mention it in my discussions of the tax policy.
Anything else from staff? We don't have any interveners in this case, and unless some of you are here on annual leave, I don't see anyone from the public, but to make it official, I'll ask whether there's any comment from the public. See, none. Is any objection to both the written as well as the oral evidence today becoming part of the record?
No objections.
Okay. So then all of our evidence today, both oral and written, will become part of the record upon which a decision is made. Are there any other matters that anyone wants to bring to our attention before we close the informal hearing? If not, the informal hearing is closed. Thank you.